Hey, Rick Sanchez here. This is Direct Impact, and this is what we're going to be talking about. Those are clashes all over the place. Israelis are fuming mad at their own government over the deaths of six hostages. I'm Rick Sanchez. Let's do this thing. So there is this outcry that suddenly developed over the weekend. Tens of thousands of people have been joining in, taking to the streets in Israel. This citizen outcry is caused by, first and foremost, the deaths of six hostages, Israeli hostages. But who are Israelis really angry at? That's an interesting question. Who are they really angry at? Mostly at their own government. They're angry at their own government. Now, let me show you, first of all, what has been going on over the weekend. Let's take a look at the pics. Yeah, it's been crazy to look at some of this. And as we look at these scenes of Israelis battling with police, we need to go beyond the deaths of the hostages and examine perhaps what caused those deaths. First, a news story that has just appeared inside Israel detailing how, listen to this. Apparently there was a secret deal recently that would create a ceasefire, what the whole world has been asking for, and return the hostages back to Israel. They had a deal. Israel agreed to it. Hamas agreed to it. But then the Israeli war cabinet said, nope, don't want to do it, don't want to do it. And they essentially sabotaged their own deal. This is crazy. That story is now appearing on an Israeli website. It's called Ynet News, heavily read. And it details how Israel changed the terms of the deal, knowing it would kill the deal. And it did. It killed the deal. It's like you having an agreement with your boss that he's going to pay you more money. You go home, you tell your husband or your wife, you're all excited, and then you get a call from your boss saying, change my mind. No deal, no contract. You're not getting a raise after all. Like, what? It's the worst thing you could do in a negotiation. It's just slimy. But anyway, I defer to the facts. This weekend, the IDF officers were conducting raids, as they often do. The six hostages were killed apparently during the raids. Now, it seems logical to assume that these hostages who had been held for so long died, right, as a direct result of these raids that were going on. However, the Netanyahu government is saying, no. Their captors just decided to kill them for no particular reason, which obviously makes no sense. It doesn't make sense to the people of Israel, who are really smart people. No matter what side of the conflict you are on, that just doesn't add up. So it appears that many Israelis get that, what we just talked about, and they're holding Netanyahu responsible for this, for killing the deal that would have set them free and then conducting raids that ended up, I guess, killing them, according to most observers. And you know who appears to agree with the Israeli people who are saying that they're really angry at their own government for killing the hostage deal? Joe Biden. President of the United States has just come out and said, starkly, by the way, about Netanyahu, that he is not doing enough to free the hostages. Joe Biden is saying Netanyahu is responsible for the hostages not being free and that he's not doing enough to free them. Let me bring in Fiorella Isabel. She's filling in for Manila today. Fiorella is the co-host of the Convo Couch. Let's start with this, Fiorella. Do you believe that Netanyahu deserves to own this criticism that he's getting, essentially being held responsible for the deaths of these hostages?
Well, of course, but I don't think he's going to. I mean, we've been seeing now for almost a year, and even before that, how his own supporters, the own Israeli people, have been turning against the Netanyahu government for various reasons. A lot of it, of course, now due to the hostage situation. And it was the Israeli government under Netanyahu that literally failed to have not just a ceasefire, but specifically what they're upset about is the hostage trade-off. And they did so via these clarifications that they decided they needed more of.
Right.
And in these clarifications, they basically wanted to change the entire thing.
Yeah.
Of course, then Hamas wasn't going to agree.
Yeah. Right? The worst thing you can do in business is negotiate with someone for hours, sometimes days. And then after the negotiation is done and you shake hands and say, OK, we got a deal. You come back the next day and say, change my mind. I want to change the deal. You can't change deals. It's immoral. It's unethical. It's wrong. And in this case, it sounds like that's exactly what they did. Let me share something.
Yeah, and not all.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. Yeah. I was just going to say that wasn't the only thing that they did. I mean, it's just also making themselves look bad to people who already have their support. And, you know, the entire world is against Israel. And now you don't even have your own people backing you. So.
Well, there's no question. For the longest time now, Israelis have not been happy with the Netanyahu government. However, they are happy with the war. They want the war to continue, but they want it to be dealt with appropriately. If to them, the idea of having a war is killing a lot of Palestinians, and they're okay with that. But they're particularly angry about the way their hostages are being treated, and that's what they're not happy about. And, this whole thing just seems extremely difficult for the rest of the world to figure out. But that's where we are right now. I want to share something else with you right now about this is something about our business, right, what I do for a living. In the TV news business, there are two types of people who do what I do for a living, two types of news presenters. The first, we call them hacks. You know what a hack is? Those are the people who do what I do, but basically they just read words off of a teleprompter that are written for them. Even their questions are actually written for them. And if you were to take that teleprompter away from those people, they would have no idea what the hell they're talking about or what their story's even about, because they never wrote the story. They barely know the story. By the way, those are the majority of the people in my business. So then there are the real ad libbers. That's what they call them. Those are the ones who can speak extemporaneously, right? And usually they do the bulk of their own writing, the bulk of their own research. And by the way, those of us who do it that way tend to be better without a teleprompter than with a prompter. I say this because it's what I thought about this weekend while I was watching Kamala Harris's first interview, right? Here, let me show you this comparison that came to my mind that I'm sharing with you now. Here's Mrs. Harris's performance at the DNC with a prompter.
We stand for freedom, opportunity, compassion, dignity, fairness, and endless possibilities.
Yeah, nice, right? Can't complain. Very beautiful, passionate, everything. Now here she is being interviewed for the very first time, no teleprompter, no less, by a friendly interviewer at CNN. What's the difference?
Turn the page on the last decade of what I believe has been contrary to where the spirit of our country really lies.
But the last decade, of course, the last 3.5 years has been part of your administration.
I'm talking about an era that started about a decade ago.
She says the last couple of years have been horrible. Wait, you were part of the last couple of years, those 10 years. She goes, oh, yeah, well, I'm talking about an era. But listen, Vice President Harris seemed halting to me. She seemed halting. She seemed cautious. Not exactly inspiring. And that's while taking questions from a friendly CNN interviewer. She probably didn't hurt herself because, you know, in the end, I'm not sure it really matters. But she seemed ineffective, almost like she was in a legal deposition, right, as opposed to engaging in a smart and honest exchange of ideas. Here's my question to you, Fiorella. Does any of this really matter? Does that interview on CNN, do you think that interview on CNN is going to get her more votes, fewer votes? What do you think?
I think it will have a minimal impact because, as you said earlier, right, this is a friendly interviewer. This is CNN. And who watches CNN? You know, the people that are already favorable to Kamala Harris, and they're going to try to have a sort of mental gymnastics competition into ways of how to twist this. And they already are all over the internet. And the thing is, it is just leaving more room for the Trump campaign to make fun of her further. I have seen nothing but comparisons to Kamala Harris for Joe Biden. So people have been comparing Kamala Harris to Joe Biden, saying that the way they stumble on their words, the way they can't really formulate great sentences, they can't publicly speak, just shows how empty and soulless they are and how much they're just being propped up by the Democratic establishment. And if we're honest, Joe Biden wasn't performing long ago, and he was just being fed line after line at the teleprompter. Well, you can see at least Kamala Harris is, you know, she's aware of who she is when she's performing on the teleprompter. But once you take that away, then you really see the lack of intellect, the lack of preparedness. And let's remind everybody, Kamala Harris is there with zero delegates. She and I had the same amount of votes in the last election, zero. Yeah, and so this is something that people are honing in on.
Yeah, there's no question that this is not a person who was actually chosen at the time by the people. But I do think it's remarkable, and my comment on that would be it doesn't matter. You know why it doesn't matter, though? The question that I asked you? Because the media doesn't matter anymore. CNN doesn't matter. Neither does Fox. Neither does ABC. Neither does Newsmax. Neither do any of them. They don't matter. They used to matter. They don't matter anymore. Because only people who watch those cable networks are watching it just to have whatever it is that they already believe confirmed. Mm-hmm. So it's not news to them, and they don't act as if it's news at any of those networks. So it is what it is. All right, third story. Imagine if the president of the U.S. traveled to another country, and while there, his or her plane, Air Force One, was seized, just taken away. Now, that would take some kind of audaciousness, right? Well, that's exactly what happened. The U.S. just did that to the president of Venezuela. They seized his plane while he was in the Dominican Republic, because they say they don't agree with how he bought it. It's so crazy. It's just nuts, if you think about this. Even the special agent tasked with taking the plane has a hard time explaining what he just did. Watch his explanation.
So today we've seized a Venezuelan-owned aircraft predominantly used by Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro in violation of U.S. sanctions and other matters that we're looking at into the aircraft.
What does that mean?
So today we seized the aircraft in violation of U.S. sanctions against Venezuela by the United States government.
Are you able to explain kind of what the sanctions were?
So it's the ongoing existing sanctions that the OFAC has levied against Venezuela for years now.
We took the plane. Why'd you take the plane? Well, we just took the plane. Why did you take the plane? What kind of sanctions? Oh, just, you know, the sanctions, the ones we've always had against Venezuela. This is the guy who's explaining. With the U.S. By the way, the U.S. presently has sanctions on a third of the countries in the world. Do you hear what I just said? The U.S. sanctions a third of the countries in the world, which means we make the rules that they all have to abide by. We tell them who they can trade with, who they can sell to, who they can buy from, where they can bank. And in the case of Venezuela, we can simply just take their assets, take their gold, take their deposits whenever we choose, why ever we choose. Why? Well, because certain people in our government don't like the president, and we disagree with his policies. Now, you can hate Maduro. You can love Maduro. Who cares? He's the president of some other country. The question most people in the Global South community would ask is, who in the hell is any country to go around telling another country what it can own, where it can go, where it can fly, who they can deal with, who they can buy stuff from? And that seems to be the case here. Fiorella, we're down to like 30 seconds, 45 seconds, but what kind of effect do you think this has globally?
It just proves that the United States is who they are, that they look at Latin America as their backyard. They're going to bully the rest of the world. And this is just another way that they have been pushing against more intervention in Latin America. They don't understand national sovereignty. And that's very clear from this man, that he couldn't even compute. He was acting like a robot that couldn't even understand the information he was given.
Yeah, it was kind of bizarre, his answer. I almost felt bad for him. I felt like he was being asked some pretty simple questions, like, why did you take the plane? And which sanctions particularly are you using to take the plane? And he was like, just the sanctions we already have. And it was like, he didn't know. And that's interesting. Hey, listen, thank you, Fiorella. Thanks so much for filling in. You were great. Hey, when we come back, the Western media seems mum on Russia these days. Why? On the situation between Russia and Ukraine. Why? Probably because Ukraine is losing. And that's who they've been pulling for. So lately, they've chosen to ignore the story, which I find fascinating, and I think a lot of people do. Semyon Boykov is an independent journalist who goes by the pen name, the Aussie Cossack. He is presently in the Russian consulate in Sydney, and he's going to be joining us to talk about some of these things in just a little bit. Stay right there. Hey, welcome back. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I'm joined now by Semyon Boykov, who uses the pseudonym the Aussie Cossack on social media and has a massive following, by the way. He's good enough to share some time with us now to talk about some of these issues. First of all, let's talk about your situation. We got to get that out of the way. You are in the Russian consulate in Sydney, Australia, correct?
That's correct.
And you're kind of hiding out there, correct?
Yeah, evading arrest, as they say, in the Australian media for 631 days. The Russian government were gracious enough to grant diplomatic asylum. I was arrested in the process of trying to leave Australia, where I was born. And unfortunately, look, the Australian government, ever since the days of COVID and lockdowns, has a tendency to persecute those who speak up and those who identified as ringleaders or journalists.
So what was your crime? So what was your crime? What do they say you did that was so wrong that they need to arrest you or kick you out of whatever they were going to do?
Well, in 2022, I was sentenced and jailed, actually, in maximum security simply for breaching a suppression order where I named a person who was before the courts accused and charged of crimes of pedophilia. Now, I named him, and many people would say that's a good thing. It's a public service to name these type of people.
Okay, but hold on. I'm going to interrupt you only because we're speaking different languages here. In most of the world, and certainly in our country here in the United States, if I call you a pedophile, a pedo, as they often refer to it, then you would sue me and take me to court, and I would have to pay you a ton of money, give you my house and everything else. The government doesn't get involved in that. It's not a criminal offense to call somebody a name. How is it that because you called somebody a name, the government came and arrested you as if you were as if they were the defenders of this person, whoever the hell it was?
Well, okay, that's a good question. The courts had a suppression order, a non-publication order, and these suppression orders usually are used to protect the witnesses or the victims, which is fair enough, and I'm completely in support of suppression orders for protecting the identities of children and victims or witnesses in these type of cases. But here the perpetrator used a suppression order, and the government, the police, saw this as an opportunity to finally arrest me and get me for, they've been wanting to do that for a very long time, and finally they got the opportunity to, you could say it's a technicality. Now, I received a 10-month custodial prison sentence, which is the highest ever sentence anyone in the history of the Australian legal system has any time received for the breaching a suppression or non-publication order. Usually, look, broadcasters, radio hosts, they do it all the time, and they just pay a fine. Sometimes they do it by accident, sometimes they do it intentionally. So it's not a big thing, and what we saw here was the Australian government using that technicality to persecute me, put me in prison. Upon being released from prison, I actually won the appeal, and I was released early. I got straight back into activism and fighting for Russia, lobbying against the Australian government, supplying billions of dollars in weapons and funding Zelensky's regime. And when the Australian government realized that I hadn't learned my lesson, I was still going to be defiant.
So in essence, what we're talking about here, just to put a button on this, is that they're going after you because they don't like the things that you're saying. If you were saying different things that their government, for example, in Australia, were in agreement with, like if you were holding a sign saying Zelensky's the greatest human being who ever lived, I love Zelensky, and everybody in Russia is bad and Putin is whatever, then they would have left you alone. But because you said the opposite, they're putting you in jail. And that's your charge here.
Exactly right. That's why it is a politically motivated charge. And when I was put into prison, I was very grateful that the Russian government, Maria Zakharova from the Russian Minister of Foreign Affairs, actually interceded, and the Russian government demanded that the Australian government release me, which is bizarre because at that time I was still an Australian citizen, born in Australia, and I did not have Russian citizenship. To have the Russian government jump in the ring to fight for you if you're not a Russian citizen is unusual, and as time passed, I ended up just defecting, basically, to the Russian consulate. I knew the police were after me again. I wasn't going to go back to prison because, look, it's okay to go to prison. You can do push-ups and you can exercise and you can spend some time there watching TV. But what you can't do is broadcast. You can't publish.
Right. You're silenced.
Can't fight for the truth. You're silenced. And that's what I couldn't afford.
So let's talk about this a little bit. And one of the things that I think it does seem unfair, whether no matter what side you choose, whether you're for Ukraine and think they're the victims or whether you're for Russia and you think they're the victims, in the general Western media, and I imagine that includes Australia, you're only really allowed to have one opinion. And I found it very curious recently that Russia seems to have been making its largest strides in the Ukraine war. It's on the brink of capturing the most important city that can turn the tide of this war. It looks like they're almost a mile away or blocks away at this point. And yet, the coverage has become mum. You hear nothing about Ukraine anymore in the U.S. media. I imagine Western media is the same. I imagine Australian media is the same. And it's only because it seems they don't like what's happening. They don't like the fact that Russia's doing well right now. When Ukraine was doing well, it was a front page story every day. Have you noticed that?
Look, you're right. And often we say it's not what happens, it's what people think happened. It's not what actually happened. It's not who holds 10 villages and who holds 15 villages or some who made 3 kilometers gains or who lost 10 kilometers. It doesn't really matter. If the picture, if the optics are fed to the West and the Western audience and the people around the world, if the optics are skewed, and that's the shock which a lot of people in the West, the Western audience are now realizing that they've been lied to. They've been saying Russia is losing. They've been saying Putin is dying. They've been saying the Russian economy is failing, that Russians don't want to fight, and so forth and so forth. It's actually the opposite. Putin's as fresh as a daisy. He just got back from an international trip where he was supposed to be arrested. Of course, nobody arrested him. The Russian economy is stronger than ever, literally stronger than ever. The Russian economy is now on a war footing, which is very scary for the West because now Russia is producing more tanks and missiles in its history since the days of the Soviet Union. And, of course, Russia, as you said, is making those big gains now, and Zelensky's in trouble.
At the very least, they're not doing badly. So, you know, even if you want to just play it down the middle and say Russia's doing fine, certainly compared to what we read in the West. The other example, most recent, is this this incursion by the Ukrainian forces into the Kursk region or the Oblast there. And to hear it told in Western media, you'd think they've captured almost all of Russia and are about to march into Moscow, when in actuality it was used as a diversion to try and get Russian troops out of that area of the Donbass. And in fact, the Russian troops have moved further into the Donbass. So once again, a narrative that is being misrepresented or mistold. I don't want to say lied because my mother said don't use that kind of language, but man, it kind of smells like it, doesn't it?
Look, definitely, that was a PR exercise, a publicity stunt. And it's a real shame that Zelensky is willing to throw his men to their deaths just for the sake of getting some headlines and trying to distract the world news or social media from the real failures on the battlefield, which for the Ukrainian army are in the Donetsk region. And the Russian army is, like you said, only a few miles away from the city of Pokrovsk.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happening in Kursk, really, although it's got a shock and awe factor about it, how dare the Ukrainian army do an incursion into Russian territory? Because Russia never expected the Ukrainians to be silly enough to do so. And of course, that's being dealt with, it's being cleaned up. But as the Chechen general Aladinov said, he mentioned yesterday, in fact, that the Ukrainians threw their best reserves into Kursk and they removed units from the other parts of the front lines to throw their troops at Kursk. Now that the Ukrainian contingent in Kursk is being defeated and being destroyed, it essentially means that now Russia has won the war completely because there are no more units. There are no men left, not on the front lines for the Ukrainians, not in the cities.
Are they, though? Are they, though? When you say, you seem to say confidently that the Ukrainian troops in Kursk are being defeated, are you sure that they're being defeated or are they just kind of being left to their own devices? Kind of kept in one area, and eventually we'll take care of that. Right now, we're busy, as you said, in the Donbas.
Well, what you're saying is true, that the Russians haven't diverted any of their main troops
Yes.
from the main front lines to Kursk, and they've just left it on hold, and in a holding pattern, so to speak. The Ukrainians haven't taken anything significant either. That area near the border, empty fields, couple of villages, perfect for making some TikTok videos in front of a supermarket. Look at us, we're in Russia. But look, I would say the situation's under control. The Ukrainians themselves blew up their own bridges, which that in the Kursk region, which they were holding, which means that they're not intending to advance further. And there is no plan for Kursk. Yeah. Zelensky today himself said that that holding Kursk is part of a grand strategy, a grand plan for victory, which it just sounds like the ramblings of a delusional madman. There is no victory. The only thing that is increasing in Ukraine is the amount of death, the amount of cemeteries that are popping up everywhere. And it's very sad that Zelensky doesn't care about Ukraine or his own people. And this is Biden's war. This is NATO's war. And they're just using these poor Ukrainian people as expendable cannon fodder. And look,
it's so sad. The best thing that could happen is you and I are going to have a conversation a month from now, and we're going to be talking about this thing finally coming to an end, and that they've got a deal. It's so frustrating to see people from both sides, including Ukrainians, of course, dying in a situation like this. And it seems to me that the world doesn't care enough to want to change it. That's the fact at this point. And I know you know that. It's just a way to button up a conversation that I think is frustrating for a lot of people all over the world. And there are a lot of people at fault. It's been a delight to talk to you. Thank you so much for taking time to take us through this and tell us your story. We really appreciate it. Thanks for being on.
Pleasure to join you, Rick. Thank you.
All right, that's our show. Remember, always look outside your own box. Truths don't live in boxes, as we like to say. We like to look at all the different perspectives. I'm Rick Sanchez. We'll be looking for you next time.